On the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio, produced by Pete Zimmerman. Hello again. This is Sean Williams. Michael Miller is a frequent guest on this show. He joins us again today as an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. Welcome back, Mike.
It's great to be with you, John.
I think it's probably wise for us to take a minute and talk about what the Fed is and what they do. We so often hear about them dictating policy and us deciphering it. What's the dictate from the Fed itself? What are they supposed to be?
The Federal Reserve is supposed to be overlook what was called monetary policy. Monetary policy is the manipulation of the money supply and the interest rates to bring about changes in macroeconomic behavior. Now, what happens is that the Federal Reserve was created under legislation. And over the years, that legislation has been slightly adjusted to say the Fed has two goals in mind. One is that they have to stabilize prices, keep inflation under control. And secondly, they want to try to create conditions so that we can have maximum sustainable employment. So what the Fed does is they have to evaluate the economy against those two, that dual mandate, and then try to create an interest rate atmosphere that will lead to an amount of spending that will take the economy to full employment with stable prices. And what we have right now is a problem for the Fed. We still have at least 4 million Americans who were working before the pandemic who aren't working now. But inflation is beginning, unusual in such a situation, it's beginning to tick upwards. So the Fed's going to have to make a very tough call. Which one do they focus upon? Do they focus upon the employment question, or do they focus upon the price question?
Is the reason that you have this contrast because of all of the money that the government has put into the system?
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying. I think that may be part of it. I think that more of it is based upon some of the supply side problems that exist in that we have these supply chain problems of raw materials necessary to make the products that people want. I think there maybe was an overreaction that the pandemic was going to destroy the economy, which it didn't. And then when people started to come back, in part because the government has provided a lot of money to the households, there is this sudden boom in demand. And when you get that mismatch between supply and demand, that can create a pricing problem, and that allows prices to rise. The big question the Fed's facing is this temporary, or is this a permanent uptick in the inflation rate that we have to deal with going forward? Of course, I don't know for sure, but I tend to fall on the side of those who argue that this is a somewhat temporary, maybe for a year or so. Mm-hmm. We will have price pressures, and then those price pressures will begin to subside.
You know, I suggested that, too, to Terry Savage, and she said, well, if you're right, if you know that and can prove it and get that right all the time, then you don't have to be a talk show host anymore. You can be anything you want. So it just shows you how little I know, because it seems to me pretty obvious what's happening here, where these bottlenecks are in the economy on the supply side, and they're all stem mostly from the pandemic, and we're going to get over that hump. So how is it not a temporary thing in that
Well, regard? Some people think that the government has put so much money into the economy, and there's so much more that could, it's called high-powered money. It's money sitting in the banks that could be lent. And I do understand that banks are beginning to loosen up on their requirements for credit cards and so forth. They're trying to get, because credit card balances are declining, which is a good thing. But there are people who believe that there is built into the system so much money that the spending will continue, and it will continuously outstrip supply. See, that's the thing. I just don't see it. We could be talking a year before things would subside. In other words, we could see inflation go to rates we haven't seen in some years for the next 6 to 12 months. But of course, the Fed has to look out at least 2 years. And I think the Fed's decision is, when you look at the bond market, when you look at inflationary expectations, looking out, say, 2 years and beyond, there is very little thinking that inflation will be much above 2% that far out. And that's why I think that I think it's a temporary phenomenon.
And 2% is sustainable for most people anyway, isn't it?
It is. The Fed finds that you don't want to have inflation at zero, because that means that certain prices have to fall to offset ones that rise due simply to scarcity. So having zero inflation is maybe in a theoretical dream a good outcome, but it's not a real world outcome that is feasible, because it can have too many effects upon employment.
Right. But here's my question, Mike. Let's pause here for just a moment, and then we'll come back with your answer to this. But you said the Fed is there to keep prices stable, keep inflation in check, but also maximize employment. If you had to pick one right now, which would you pick? If you're going to err on one side, which side do you err on? And I want you to revisit the topic for us one more time, because there was some writing about this last week as well. Do unemployment benefits discourage people from going back to work? And if so, where's the line in the sand? It's 12:14. We're talking to Mike Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University, on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Michael Miller's on a phone line. We're talking to the Associate Professor of Economics over at DePaul. He's telling us a little bit about the Fed and how, however wonkish and far away that sounds, it affects you and me on a day-to-day basis. What we pay for goods and services, and whether or not there's a better chance you're going to get a job or a better one. If you had to err on one side, if the Fed professor is supposed to keep inflation in check but also maximize employment, and those are dueling interests right now, what side do you err on?
The decision for me, I think, is, I don't want to say obvious, but I would normally be one who would focus mainly upon inflation, because that's ultimately the only variable that the Fed truly can manage over time. However, we have had inflation below 2% target for the past almost 10 years. So what we have is a situation where 4 million Americans are still out of work. So if I'm going to err, I'm going to err on the side of having those people go back to work, to have the economic growth necessary for them to go back to work. Now, let's assume that that leads to a little more inflation than the Fed wants, which is that 2% target. But what the Fed decided to do starting last November was to focus not on the inflation rate per se, but the inflation rate on average over, say, a 2 or a 5 year period. And what we can see here is inflation could jump to, say, 2.5%, 3.5% for the next 6 months, and we would still be on average at 2%. And if that would allow us then to get some of those 4 million people back to work, I think that's a good trade-off.
It's been so long since inflation has been a conversation anyway, I've kind of forgotten how impactful that can be. I'm like, what, 2% more on something? If it's too expensive, I won't buy it. And I got 2% or 3% in me anyway, particularly since so many people have had extra cash thrown at them these days. I'm sure there's a lot of naivete in that thinking, but that's where my head is right now, Professor.
No, your thinking is okay. As long as your take-home pay goes up, matching the increase, the 2%, and that's kind of built in. If everybody expects 2%, and therefore pay raises and so forth are based upon that, we can actually not have harm caused by the 2% inflation. The problem comes that when inflation rises unexpectedly, and your incomes don't rise, that hurts the households in terms of they don't have as much money then to buy the basket of goods that they need to buy. And over time, what they would hope is that they will catch up. I just don't, again, some people are going to be hurt by this sudden spike in inflation. I don't deny that the case. But there will be the advantage, I think, that by stimulating the economy with continuously low interest rates, that more people will go back to work, more production will occur, and then we'll get that supply-demand problem more in line. There won't be the same supply issues that there have been over, say, the past couple of months.
Well, I imagine the poorer people would be most impacted by inflation, but they're the ones I'm thinking about. I want to get more people working as well. So that's the dance we're doing.
That's the trade-off. You're exactly right. Certainly, when it comes to inflation, the people on the bottom in the middle are the ones hurt more. Inflation hurts the poor and the middle class more than it hurts the rich.
What about this story, Professor? I want to change subjects before I lose you for this segment. The world economy is suddenly running low on everything. There's a Bloomberg story, and it's not just here in the USA that there's a shortage of goods. Are you tracking that, and what does that mean generally? How does that impact us?
Well, that's that supply chain problem, and that we need certain strategic inputs like copper and so forth to make sure that we have enough wires to build homes and things like that. And certainly when you would have the pandemic, everybody would kind of close in on themselves, and we wouldn't produce too much, so we don't have to hold huge inventories, which can be very expensive. But then if you have this surprise return of the economy, a surprise vaccine that came much sooner than we thought, you have this pent-up demand. Again, you get this mismatch between the supply ability of firms, which responds more slowly than demand. Because when you decide, I'm going to get a washer, you do that today and you want it today. But when it comes time to try to produce a washer, that takes time. And so there is a lag that exists when it comes to the supply side, and that's the lag we're seeing, which is causing these prices to rise.
I hadn't thought about it. Is this around the globe? Are people in France and China and South America also waiting for washers and dryers?
Not as much as we are, because you know that I think Europe fell into a recession in the first quarter of the year. But now that the vaccines are getting spread throughout those countries as well, and if travel between those countries begins to come back, I think they will have some of the same problems. So this is an international issue. Yes, it's not just a local issue.
Has the conversation changed at all since the last time you and I spoke about does an unemployment supplement discourage people from going back to work? I saw pro and con reporting on that last week.
Yeah, you know, I'm really torn. As I've said before, I always, on such matters, I always wait to see what the literature tells me. And it takes time to run the studies to try to figure this out. When I look at it, it certainly makes sense that if I'm going to be paid to stay home, I would stay home because leisure is preferred to work. But at the same time, I look at it and I say, you know, people realize that this is a temporary phenomenon, that money is going to be taken away. And on top of that, some people they can't go back to work, maybe because of childcare problems and so forth. So, and when you realize the number of women, for example, who were affected during the pandemic in the leisure industry and so forth, I think there's more at work here than just the fact that the government's paying kind of I don't want to say a ransom, but they're paying some extra money to people to stay at home. I think when it's all done, that will have played some role, but I'm not convinced it's going to play the major role that people are making it out to be.
I guess this is an economics thing, that the state of Ohio has a lottery. If you get the vaccine, they'll put your name in it, and $5 million winners' names will be drawn.
Yeah.
Is that good policy? Do you think that's a smart way to get people to get the vaccine?
That's funny you bring that up. A couple of colleagues and I went back and forth on that, and we are divided among my, I think, very smart PhD economists with whom I interact on a daily basis. Some of us think yes, some of us think no. Only no in that this is not a role of government, but in terms of, is it an incentive that could get people to get vaccinated, and it would have that positive effect on everybody in that we would get closer to herd immunity? The answer is yes. So I thought there were really good arguments on both sides, and I don't think economists have the strict answer as to whether this is a good or bad policy decision.
You know, here's where I come down on this. I think everybody should get vaccinated. I've been vaccinated. I'm on team vaccine, and I also play the lottery when it gets rich enough, but I think it's a false promise. The government lures $1 million in front of people, and only five people in a state of 8 million are going to get the money. So
yeah.
I don't like government doing that. I understand by any means necessary, but that's kind of there's something about the ethic of that that bothers me.
Yeah, see, that was my side, John. You and I are actually on the same page when it comes to this. I get the point of having the incentive, and if the incentive's large enough, people will do something they weren't going to do. They'll take that chance and get the vaccine. I just don't think that's something government should be doing, and you and I seem to agree on that. I do understand why they're doing it. The thing that bugs me is that I think we're not giving enough evidence or enough emphasis on those who have natural immunity because they had the disease in the first place. They, in a sense, we never in the past have asked such people to get a vaccine. Maybe they should not get this vaccine, which means they can't be part of the $1 million.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting carve out on that. I have 30 seconds left. Do we tax the rich enough in this country on this year's tax day?
I believe that if you look at the percentage of the total taxes paid by the rich, we are as progressive or more progressive than almost any country in the world. So do I think that the rich pay their fair share? I think the answer is yes. The reason we don't have enough tax revenue to match exactly what we want to spend is because we are unwilling to tax the middle class at a slightly higher rate to pay for all the benefits which the middle class and the lower class get from many of these government programs.
And here we were getting along so nicely, you and me.
I know. I knew that was going to set you off.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Professor. Thank you.
You got it.
Mike Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. And if you needed advice from someone, take his, not mine. Catherine Davis is our guest now. Welcome back, Catherine. I hope you're well.
Hi, John. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to hear. Associate editor at Chicago Inno. The city council is reconsidering scooters. We've been through this a few years now. What's the status of scooters in the city of Chicago?
Yeah, so over the last couple years, the Chicago Department of Transportation has run limited pilots for the e-scooters to operate in neighborhoods throughout Chicago. And the idea, it was basically an experiment to see, you know, are these a good way for Chicagoans to get around? Are they causing issues? Do people like them or do they not? And the data shows that people generally are using them in the correct ways and do like them, and that they are, sort of a great addition to CTA and Ubers and cars and all the other ways that we're getting around. And so the city council and CDOT last week announced that they are going to talk soon about the future of e-scooters and, eventually making them a permanent part of our transportation system and not just making them available in these, 3-4 month pilot programs. So it'll be interesting to see what they decide. I've been covering these e-scooters for a few years now, and it's been a long time coming, but, making a prediction, I do think we'll be seeing scooters have a permanent presence here eventually.
Well, if they generate revenue, they will. As long as it's, I guess the way to look at it would be not just do they generate revenue, but are we robbing Peter to pay Paul? If people are less likely to take the CTA or other revenue generating forms of public transportation, then maybe you're cutting off your nose to spite your face there. I presume they've sort of done the math on that, huh, Catherine?
Yeah, I believe that every ride you pay a tax to the city. So I think the city is making some money through these. Well,
you also noted in your article that when it first came out in 2019, people were complaining everywhere and you were seeing pictures of them in the river or in a ditch, and that we've sort of gotten used to it. And I think that's anecdotally been my observation as well. But I wonder if the city says, okay, this is going to be a permanent fixture in the transportation landscape in Chicago. Are we going to see a lot more of them then? Are they going to, since this was a test period, allow them to put even more scooters on the streets?
Yeah, that's a fair assumption. I think in the last pilot, there was about 10,000 scooters. And those were just, they were in most areas of the city, but not downtown, just because it gets too congested there. I'm sure that we would see more scooters if these were here permanently. And to your point about, seeing them in the river and cluttering sidewalks and whatnot, in the most recent pilot, the city had a new regulation that every scooter had to come with a lock so that you could tie it to a bike rack or a street sign. And the data shows that really cut down on the number of clutter complaints. So people weren't tripping over them in the sidewalk, or cars weren't running across them in the street or anything. They were pretty organized, which made the experience much better for riders and non-riders.
And I guess I'm just past the fact, and I guess we don't have 1,000 people a day cracking their skulls on those things, but people don't wear helmets when they're riding them. They go really fast. They are in traffic. And it's amazing that we haven't had more collisions with those things. And maybe we will when more folks start driving downtown. But I guess we've all kind of reached an equilibrium on those things, and they seem to be relatively safe, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say you take the same precautions as you do when you ride a bike.
Yeah.
You
wear a helmet mostly when you're riding bicycles. There's no helmets on these scooters.
Right, yeah. And since people are generally just getting on them for one-off rides, they're not preparing themselves for a scooter ride and would be bringing that equipment.
Yeah, so. And I've heard, I remember in 2019, there was some discussion about ways to amend that or remedy that, but I haven't seen much of that. I wanted you to also talk a little bit about, there's a couple of other stories, home insurance startup Kin, K-I-N. What is this?
Yeah, so Kin is a cool startup in Chicago, founded back in 2016, and they're basically making home insurance easier and cheaper to buy. And we wrote about them last week because they raised a $64 million funding round to keep growing and hire new employees. So far, their insurance is offered in some southern states, I believe Florida, California, and Louisiana. California's on the West Coast. But the idea with launching in these states is that this is generally where you're seeing extreme weather events like earthquakes or hurricanes, where people really need home insurance because, you know, there's just such a threat to their home being damaged or destroyed. But, you know, Kin has been around for a few years now, and they continue to grow. So they're pretty similar to another company called Lemonade, which offers insurance as well to homeowners and renters. But the idea is that they've kind of cut out the middleman and agents, and they can just sell insurance directly to consumers, which makes it cheaper and simpler.
Is the opposite available? Can I be in an insurance group that doesn't include Louisiana, Florida, and California, and then I'm not subsidizing hurricanes and fires?
Can you be the opposite?
Well, yeah. I mean, if this, I understand the niche maybe that they found, they'll go ahead and cut out the middleman, you're saying, right? And then they sell to people who are maybe paying a premium for insurance. But how about if we do the opposite and just pick the safest states, like Iowa and Illinois, right? No hurricanes here. You know, the occasional tornado, but I like our chances. And then let's just have an insurance company for a pool of people in a very safe part of the country rather than in these more dangerous ones.
Right. Hey, that's a great business idea.
I think
you should start a startup.
I should not.
I think Kin eventually does plan to offer its service in all 50 states. You know, we've seen a lot of other insurance companies, insurance startups, they start in a few states and they eventually expand. As you know, the insurance laws are different state by state. So there's kind of a lot of hoops to jump through, and it takes a while for that expansion. But I believe that Kin's, idea is to be an insurance platform in every state.
Maybe someday Catherine Davis will be interviewing me for Chicago NO. And so he had a novel idea. He picked the safest place in America where nothing bad ever happens and sold those people insurance. All right, Catherine.
Hey, that would be great.
Until that day, thanks for your time.
Thanks, John.
Associate Editor, Chicago NO. Amy Guth's looking at some business for us. We'll get to her in a couple of minutes. First, back into the WGN Radio Newsroom, here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. United Airlines says July will be a big month. It's adding 400 daily departures to its schedule. The new flights will cover destinations in the U.S. and Europe. United expects to hit 80% of its 2019 domestic U.S. schedule in July on bookings that are up 214% compared to 2020. Compared to June of 2021, United will increase its schedule 17% for July, making July United's largest month from a scheduling perspective since the pandemic hit. Stellantis is cutting more than 1,600 jobs at its Illinois Jeep plant. This is the latest indication of the deepening chip shortage and its impact on the auto industry. The company will cut the second shift at its Belvedere plant by July 26th. Stellantis was formed by the merger of Fiat Chrysler and French rival PSA Group. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve Alexander joins us with the business of food.
You know, Johnny, every now and then I like to remind you, as Orion did occasionally, that if not for the great men and women of agriculture, you'd be hungry, homeless, naked, and sober. And I'm not encouraging irresponsible drinking here, but if you like a little hooch in your booch, meaning kombucha, the fermented tea that many of us can't do without, there's this.
We ferment ours twice, and we add some champagne yeast, which bumps up the alcohol content into 6%.
That's Bridget Connolly, a native of Oak Park, Fenwick High School. She and co-founder Claire Ridge, another Chicago native, are changing the face of the booze biz.
You know, we really created the category for hard kombucha. There were no other hard kombuchas really before we launched. We're one of the very few female-founded alcohol companies in the U.S., and it's just an exciting time to be a part of the alcohol and distribution space.
Luna Bay Booch is the name of the product. She says the company started in California, but knowing what they know about Chicago, they figured it would be a great market.
It's a city that likes to have fun, but is also, you know, health conscious as well. You know, we can't claim, obviously, that the alcohol is good for you, but there are better for you qualities in our product. It is vegan. It is gluten-free. All of the ingredients we source are non-GMO, real fruits, real lavender flowers, hibiscus flowers. And then, of course, there's cultures in the product. So there are probiotic strains, which are good for your gut.
You can find it in all the usual places, Binny's, Whole Foods, Mariano's.
A lot of places around Chicago. It's one of our best markets. We're really thankful for the city of how much support they've given us.
And Bridget Connolly says the idea of hard kombucha is catching on. She says Luna Bay Booch is now in 10 states. LunaBayBooch.com. Chicago Board of Trade is trying to make up for, well, they had huge losses last week for corn, beans, and wheat, each down 3-4%. Corn right now is up only about 3 cents at $6.46 a bushel. Beans are up or down now about 4 cents at $15.82 a bushel. And wheat is right at $7, down 7.25 cents. Today is National Cherry Cobbler Day, also National Walnut Day. I think it's okay to mix those two. That's the business of food and Booch on 720 WGN.
We've talked about how people are working from home, or as they say, living at work. But there's some research out now. Amy Guth joins us on the Business Lunch to talk about how debilitating all of this work has been for us this year. Is that right, Amy?
Well, it's taking even bigger look than that. And I think many people, myself included, I think a lot of us are doing kind of a self-assessment today on this news. And that is a report from the World Health Organization and the International Labor Organization, which is an agency of the UN. They've released a report taking a look specifically at the years 2000 through 2016. And some of these numbers are pretty shocking. And essentially, working long hours are killing about 745,000 people a year, specifically from heart attack and stroke. That if you work over 55 hours a week, your risk of both goes up quite a bit. More specifically, working over 55 hours a week, your increased risk of dying from heart disease is up by 42%, and by stroke, 19%. Now, the World Health Organization did note that this was, you know, pre-pandemic data, but they fear these numbers might actually be more severe now that the lines have blurred and a lot of people are reporting working more because you're home. So it's not like, oh, shoot, I left the office. I can't do that. I'll do it tomorrow. No, you're home. So you just kind of do it. So their concern is that these numbers might actually be more severe now when they're already pretty stark numbers. I mean, 55 hours a week, I wouldn't say that's out of the realm of possibility for a lot of people. And another thing I thought was interesting was, it's not that the work will necessarily be, putting you at risk right away. It's often years later when it shows up, which I thought was something really interesting. So particularly in middle age, so the 40s and up, if you're putting in those kind of hours, it might impact your health later on.
So that'd be, say, 11 fives is 55 or 55 into the week if you're working at home and you seem to be working every day of the week, a little here, a little there.
Yeah.
You're right. It's blurred, and probably 55 is a number a lot of us can get to pretty easily. And this is sobering news.
Yeah, I had the same thought. I thought, oh, gosh. I looked at my calendar last week and thought, oh, geez, I think I did that.
I'm there.
Yeah.
And it's not like you keel over in the 55th hour, but rather, like any bad habit, it'll eventually catch up with you, which is, again, just gives one pause, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. So where they put it kind of in the overall was your risk of stroke and or fatal heart disease. They compared it with people who work 35 to 40 hours.
Yeah.
And even later, that data still suggested, and this is taking a broader look than just that little slice, 35% higher risk of stroke and 17% higher risk of heart disease than the people who work 35 to 40 hours. So I think for both bosses and workers, this is pretty, you know, big wake-up call that this is something perhaps we should look at. So the World Health Organization recommended that governments introduce and implement and really reinforce laws and regulations and policies that ban mandatory overtime and really try to take this seriously. And because they're, you know, considering it a public health issue.
Yeah, companies should pay attention to this, too, if the governments don't. But in a way, it's so counterintuitive. If you have more hours, presumably you make more money, you're more in demand, you're needed, you're working. You've got more resources then to take care of your health. I would imagine people working less than 40 hours would suffer more health-wise than those working over 40 hours, at least relative to strokes and heart attacks. This is the opposite of that. So I'm really sorry you joined us today.
All right. Sorry to be a bunch of bad news.
Hey, talk to me about people cutting the cord. What's happening with AT&T on that?
Yeah, really interesting news here. It's a kind of a shift. So earlier this morning, AT&T and Discovery announced a deal that they're going to spin off Warner Media and combine that in a new standalone media company. So AT&T is going to refocus more on the telecom part. And this new kind of spun-off company, it's going to have a lot that's really going to compete in that that streaming space. So it's going to encompass CNN, HBO, TNT, TBS, Discovery, the Food Network, HGTV, Oprah's channel. I mean, that's a lot of big, you know, heavy hitters there in the streaming space. It's still going to be smaller than like the Netflix and the Amazon, you know, those big streaming services. But nonetheless, this is a big move. But I thought it was interesting to be spinning off this Warner Media piece, as you know, there's been so much conversation on AT&T and Warner Media for quite a while. But pulling back from kind of this years-long campaign into the streaming and entertainment sector, and saying, you know what, we're going to put this in a separate bucket entirely. So we'll see what comes from that and what that looks like. But here's another big player in the streaming space.
What's going on at the Jeep plant in Illinois?
Yeah, well, you know, you and I have been talking about this chip shortage and how that's impacting automakers. And here's just another example of that. So Stellantis is cutting shifts at an Illinois Jeep factory. It's in Belvedere. They're cutting over 1,600 jobs. And so they had been idled in February, in April, and in earlier in May. So, you know, to me, this is kind of pointing at, and I think some other, some economists and industry watchers that kind of echoed this in various outlets of kind of, you know, we're thinking of this chip shortage as being very temporary. And well, when the bottleneck is resolved, everybody will get back to work. But in fact, cutting 1,600 plus jobs is a more significant move that really could be hinting at a lot more lasting damage. And this is particularly, this factory makes Jeep Cherokee SUVs. And even though car sales has been up and even finding a car has been really difficult for people, even dealers have been, you know, struggling to replenish their supply lately. The Jeep Cherokee in particular, you know, they saw some lower numbers. So they sales were down 29% last year, and deliveries of the Jeep brand fell 14%, you know, overall to dealers. So it might be particular to this brand that they're saying, hey, we're losing market share. We're going to put resources somewhere else. This could be about a wider impact that is a little bit longer lasting to the auto industry.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We'll talk again later this week. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.